I hope you can. Anyway, so we're trying to make sure that we keep this Buddhist society as comfortable as possible for everybody. And for today, to giving a talk, and quite often I haven't got a clue what I'm going to talk about, I really admit that. You know, instead of getting afraid and getting scared of what's going to be said, it is a lot of time I look at people's eyes. You often see me scanning you when I start the meditation to see you to pick up what you want me to talk about. And of course, it's the beginning of a new year, and often that people look at the idea of beginnings as a start for doing things afresh, doing things new, especially if the last year has not been as you would have expected and caused a bit of suffering, pain, disappointment or whatever. And sometimes we look at occasions like a new year as an opportunity to do something a little bit different, to try again, actually to see if we can find out what went wrong and what works. You know, looking at what went wrong, why it went wrong, why it is that you didn't get that beautiful relationship, why you didn't get that increase in salary in the job, or you got even sacked from the job, why you couldn't overcome the health problems, why? You know what that word is in Buddhism, the why, where it comes from, what's the reason? That is called Dhamma. That's the meaning of that word. It's looking at this experience now and seeing its causes, why this happened, where this comes from. And I have to give a lot of credit for that idea. You know, from the great Buddhist scholar Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, you know, he's now in the United States, who had a philosophy degree, but he also was fluent in Pali. And just get the idea of what this word Dhamma means, the cause, the root of things. Which is one of the reasons that the word why is a very important question in all parts of the spiritual search. Why? Why did this happen? Why did this sickness come? Why am I just hurting? Am I not at peace with? Why am I depressed? Because when one asks that question, why, when it's actually looking in the right direction, if you look at who is to blame, then that gets nowhere. Because you can think, oh, it's your parents, it's the government, it's Donald Trump, it's the media, it's this or that. My goodness, you can't prove any of that. You don't really know. And if you start thinking it's me to blame, I shouldn't have done it, I should have done something else, I should have been more careful, blah, blah, blah. It's the same, it doesn't get you anywhere. So the blame game of trying to look for finding fault with somebody, that gets you nowhere. In fact, it not only makes you more tense, but it also stops actually seeing what the truth of this relationship with life is. You know, why do we get upset sometimes? Why is it that sometimes we don't like what we see? Which is one of the reasons why that last night when we had our New Year's Eve celebrations, in order to make it fun but also meaningful, we just don't just do fun, we make, you know, the finding the spiritual meaning of life joyful. So I was putting on the screen there some of the quotes that learning that it's not changing the world but changing your relationship with it is a path to peace and happiness. Of course, you know, that is controversial because there's many important problems we have to face in this world and solve them. But I've seen this too often in my life. If you don't have the right attitude, then trying to solve the world's problems creates more problems. So we have a change of attitude in our world. And that change of attitude to our world is asking why? Why do these things happen? Why do good people end up doing bad things? Why? And sometimes if we own the problem and we feel responsible for it ourselves, and it's all about me, of course that's going to go terribly wrong. And that's why also on last night I said we also have to make sure that it's not, we're not standing up for ourselves, for our own problems, for what we need, for our own religion, our own group, our own gender, our ownness. That whenever you are assertive, the quote went, we are assertive for the sake and well-being and happiness of us. Not me, not my friends, but everybody. Not just every human, animals, the planet, the whole thing. May all beings, all things be happy and well. And I love that idea because sometimes just to test out these qualities of changing a relationship to things and what actually happens. It's amazing to some, oh no, I was a theoretical physicist before I became a monk at Cambridge. I would have seen Stephen Hawking, but he wasn't famous then, so I'd done, and I think he wasn't in a wheelchair, so I wouldn't have known who I went past. But I certainly remember going to his lecturer, Professor Sharma, who taught this incredible stuff, astrophysics of the galaxy. And trouble was, when I went to listen to lectures like that, it just so blew my mind. It was just so incredible stuff. I stopped taking any notes and just zonked out on just the meaning of astrophysics of the galaxy. That was so cool. But anyway, so, you know, after a while, I just, it's one of my problems. I just enjoy life too much. Instead of stopping my enjoyment and going to deeper understanding, my relationship with that was a little bit to enjoyment rather than finding out more meaning. But anyway, that even though that was my background, still, nevertheless, you always realize it's not just the world outside, it's the people in it and how we relate to it, how we interact with the world. And how the world interacts with us as a result. And when we can investigate that, we find out the reason why there's so many problems in our world. Some of it is, again, expecting ourselves, our partner, the monks we live with, the people you meet, expecting them all to be way more perfect than they can ever be. Like you. Are you perfect? Have you made any mistakes today? Have you done anything wrong? Is there anyone in this room who hasn't made a mistake today? That's today. That's this year. That was your mistake. Is there anything wrong with making mistakes? No, mistakes happen. And when they do happen, why? What is the cause of those mistakes? The deeper cause of when mistakes happen is learning, growing. Only when we make mistakes do we know sort of why those are mistakes. Why we just, you know, go into the park, don't walk on the grass. You walk on the grass. And like happened once when we were doing a big ceremony in our monastery in China Grove, when people were dancing on the grass, and then the reticulation system came on, and they all got terribly wet. That's one of the funniest experiences, because all these people are Thai dancers, all dressed up, you know, in their Thai dancing garb, and they were dancing. Well, I can't do Thai dancing. They just this and that. And then they were just really getting into it, and bzzz, as all the water started coming up. I think that was one of the greatest exhibitions of Thai dancing gone wrong I've ever seen. It was so funny. Not for them, of course, but anyway. I knew where the switch was, and I should have turned it off much quicker. But I must admit I indulged in that. Oh, I apologize, but... But we always learn from our mistakes, and when we learn from those mistakes, that's where we grow. So we don't get angry at our mistakes. This is one of the biggest things which I learned from Buddhism as a young man. We don't punish mistakes. You know, we almost like celebrate mistakes. This is where we learn and we grow and we do much better next time, as long as they're not really great big mistakes, like blowing up Dhammaloka Buddhist Center or something. But, you know, no, please don't do that. But if it's a tiny mistake. What was one of those mistakes some years ago? I love repeating this little anecdote because it gives me much more idea and much more understanding of, you know, the etiquette of what you do when you come to a Buddhist center like this. And that was here one Friday evening, you know, I started doing the meditation, and in the corner over there somewhere, a couple of years ago, actually quite a few years ago, there was a lady, and after I started the meditation, she lay down on the ground. We said, that's okay. But then she lay down on the ground, and after 5 minutes, she started snoring really loud. And I opened up one eye, not both eyes, and saw the people around and stopped sleeping. And I was trying to tell them, leave her alone, leave her alone. Because I talked to her before the meditation. And when I was talking to her before the meditation, this poor lady was a victim of domestic abuse. Really quite severe. And she'd come to this place because she thought it was safe. And it was safe. This is a safe place here. Hopefully you can feel that safety here. And so just almost automatically she lay down. And she said afterwards to me, this is the first place she felt she could close her eyes and take a nap in weeks. At home, she was terrified that if she lost her consciousness, she'd get attacked. So afterwards, I told people, when they realized what was going on, they were much more at ease when people don't do the things they're supposed to do. Snoring during meditation, what's wrong with that when you realize why they're doing it? They're having a bit of peace. So from this day on, that day on, I've always told people that if you fall asleep during the meditation at this place or during my talks, please don't snore during my talks, you won't get offended, because I realize that sometimes people, where they're coming from, they need to take a break and relax. You understand the why, and it just means you don't blame people. When you don't blame people, you can make peace with people, and then it creates so much more happiness in your life and happiness in their life, even just by not interfering with the lady who was taking a few minutes because, you know, she hadn't slept for days. It was a wonderful gift everybody in this room could do. Once you explain it that way, there's hardly anything which can disturb you anymore. Just like a similar story, which I love telling, usually on retreats, is of this gentleman in a retreat I was giving in Sydney many years ago. And this gentleman, he told me, you know, his problem, why he'd come on this retreat for 9 days, was because he had sinus cancer. He had this huge tumor, you know, up in the bridge of his nose, which meant he hadn't been able to breathe through his nose in days. And gone to the doctors, he was obviously a very smart, wealthy man. When he went to the doctors gave him every possible therapy. But eventually, like happens to some people, the oncologist, the cancer specialist, said, there's nothing more we can do. We tried everything, but the cancer is still growing. So just prepare yourself to die. And of course, you know, he thought, no, I've got to try something else. So that's why he came to my retreat. He came to my retreat as the last throw of the dice, as they say, just to see if meditation can be of assistance. But the problem was that, you know, he was very diligent, getting up early and sitting in the hall and meditating as much as he possibly could. The problem was that every time he closed his eyes and started to meditate, because he could only breathe through his mouth. And of course, that first day, I always have a box for questions when I do my retreats. And the first day, all the questions in the box are most of them. Ajahn Brahm, could you please tell people to breathe quietly in the meditation hall? It's disturbing us. And of course, once I got that complaint, that blaming somebody else, and I mentioned that poor gentleman is dying of sinus cancer. And he's going to come here, his last chance to do some meditation. And that's all he can do. He can't breathe quietly. You know, from that day on, there was no questions at all, and there was no trying to get him to go out of that hall and just meditate somewhere else. There was no sort of blaming at all, or ill will. And the people told me that, oh, he's welcome to come in here. It's wonderful that he can come and meditate, and it doesn't disturb us. Now we know where that's coming from. No blaming. But I love telling that story because of what happened next. First of all, they let him make a noise during the meditation, and I could hear it too, but it generated a lot of kindness and compassion towards him, because that could be his last stages of life. But then, and this is also something, the reason I tell this on meditation retreats, the very last meditation of a 9-day retreat. All these other meditations he'd done, nothing had happened. But the very last, I knew it was the last meditation, because I was getting in the car to go to Sydney Airport to come back to Perth. And he came running out of the hall. He said, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, please stop. He said, I've got to get to the airport to get the plane, I might be late. He said, no, look, it'll only take a few minutes. He said his last meditation, that he heard a popping sound in his nose. Pop. And he could breathe through his nose. For about 1 minute, then it closed up again. But that really shook him. The tumor had got smaller because he could breathe through his nose. And he said, he never expected that. And of course, one of the reasons we call this Dharma, for why is it that you get some really nice meditation when it's the very last meditation of a retreat? You know why? It's because you've got nowhere in all your meditations, nothing has happened, you realize you're hopeless. And I don't know how many people have been on my retreats or been here and think they're hopeless. You do that on purpose, you know. Because once you think you're hopeless, then you stop trying. Then you relax, you lower your standards, and then things happen. Amazing things happen. Because it was not expected, he was not trying anymore. That's why he got really peaceful. And his tumor got smaller. And he could feel that. There wasn't imagination. He could actually breathe through his nose. And he asked me, what should I do next? And I said, you know, I had to get in the car to get to the airport. I said, oh, just carry on, see what happens. The usual Ajahn Brahm remark. And of course I really did think that he'd left it too late. But then what happened 6 months later, you know, I only tell the stories where they're really good stories, where something happens. The time when it fails, when my teachings don't work. Of course I won't do. Yeah, I do sometimes. But anyway, 6 months later, another place, giving a talk, and this guy comes up to me and says, do you remember me? I don't know why people ask me that question. It happens so often. Do you remember me? How can I? You know, how many people in this room tonight? I don't know, but 200 people. And there was a lot more this morning. And you go overseas and sometimes you give talks to thousands of people. And sometimes it was 6 years ago. I remember this Sri Lankan lady once came up to me, do you remember me? Said, you know, he gave a talk in this big convention center, BMICH, you know, in Colombo. I was one of the participants there. There's about 10,000 of them. Do you remember? Look, it's impossible. But anyway, this person, he said, do you remember me? And I said, no. I'm always honest that way. Well, these days, sometimes, so I don't upset people, sometimes. I think I got this from a joke book somewhere. Now, joke books have got some wisdom sometimes. So somebody comes up, do you remember me? And I say, oh, yeah, you're the the girl whose name I keep forgetting. That gets you out of a bind, anyway. You're the person whose name I keep forgetting. Who are you? Keep forgetting your name. No, no. So, but anyway, I was honest. I said, I don't know who you are. And then he said he was that guy. And honestly, he looks totally different. You know, when you're dying of cancer, you know, you're really emaciated, not much flesh on your body, and you feel really, look really sort of, you look like you're dying. But now he said he carried on meditating as I taught him, and he came there to thank me. He said, the tumor got smaller and smaller for longer and longer, and now it's totally gone. Check with my doctors, I'm fine. Thank you so much. And of course that gives you lots of joy, you know, when somebody comes to thank you for, you know, teaching them to overcome their cancer. But also I asked him what he's doing now. He said, I'm spending the rest of my life teaching what you taught me. So other people can have another way. Maybe it won't work for everybody, but it works for some. And of course that made me so happy to see this guy, which I could not really recognize. But it reminded me of another story. Please forgive me if my talks ramble off on all over the place. The monks are used to this, the rambling talks, but one thing leads to another. This is like life. Life doesn't follow one particular direction. It's a cause and effect. That effect is a cause for something else to happen. And sometimes your life has gone in directions you've never really thought were going to happen. When you look back upon it and see all the little causes and effects, you can see how it actually happens, why you ended up coming here tonight. But anyway, this was another time when I went to a big event here in Perth. And again, the person organizing this event was really looking for me and came up to me and said, do you remember me? But she was smiling and she was laughing, and then she told me the story. This was in the education department in Perth. I think the southern part of the education department was having a big conference, and they wanted me to give a talk at this conference and to be one of the VIPs. And of course, they never explained why they wanted me to go there until she came up to me and said, do you remember me? And then she told me the story that years earlier, I'd gone to her school where she was the principal. And it was in Armidale or Kelmscott or something. But it was a very low socio-economic area. She was the principal of this school, and it was really a tough school. And when I went to her school to give a talk, one of the things I said at that time was, like, now is the only time you have, and give it everything you've got. And I've said a few other things, like the opening the door of your heart story, but that idea of now is the only time you have, and give it everything you've got, really affected her. And that evening, as soon as I finished my talk and she went home, she wrote out her resignation as principal to the education department. She resigned that night, she told me. And she said there was something she always wanted to do. She'd noticed there's many kids in that low socioeconomic area who disappeared from school. Kids who would leave the grid of education. And she wanted to find out, first of all, why. Not to assume they were bad kids, but actually to find out why. So she was a principal. And then she left her job. And then she started walking about sort of Northbridge, and she said, under some of the bridges in Perth, to find these kids. And one thing which she had was this wonderful idea of non-judgment, not stigmatizing people, opening the door of your heart to the person in front of you, no matter who they were. And then she developed this sense of trust. She was a principal of a school before. Now she was not working and just doing some research herself by going out and meeting some of these kids who should have been in school. And of course the stories were just so horrendous. There were kids who were beaten up at school, or beaten up in their homes, not really giving any breakfast or proper food. Parents, alcoholics, they'd run away from school, who didn't understand, didn't meet what they needed, and were living on the streets. And some really girls were just getting by with prostitution, underage. Actually, all ages are underage for prostitution, if you look at it that way. But anyway, that they were just living a really miserable life. What she asked them when she found out, you can't judge people for some of the choices they made under horrendous situations. But then she asked them, what do we need to do to get you back into school? And she listened, opening the door of her heart to the people she was meeting. And after a lot and lot of this type of research, not judging a person, because if you judge a person and you want to punish them, then you know what happens? They don't tell you the truth, or they run away. In order to get that information, the truth, you've got to really listen and not stigmatize and get people to trust you. I'm not going to tell the police. Punishment's not going to work. What's going to only work is when you trust me and just open up. Why? What you need. And then, after getting the research, because she was a principal before, she went back to her bosses in the Department of Education in Perth, and she proposed a different type of education for these kids. An education which was much more suited to them. I don't know all the details, but you know, somebody in the Department of Education realized that this lady had cred. She'd been a principal before. She knew what she was talking about. She'd done the research, not at universities, but on the street. And they gave her a go. She started this program. And she, you know, it was incredibly successful at the time. And she said, well, you know, you were the guy who inspired me to do this. That's why I've invited you to come and give a talk. And of course, even when I remember that now, that just goosebumps and teary eyes, that again, something in these teachings that actually worked for some of the people in the most difficult situations. And so I was in a VIP table, but there's two other kids in that table, one I'll never forget, this boy. So I gave my presentation at this conference. And then she invited the kid to give his story. He was 17 now, I think 18. And he told the story of his life, rejected by his family, and just living on the street, getting into trouble after trouble, well known by the police. And then he said that this, at last, over all these years, this person, the ex-principal, listened to him. Actually listened without any judgment, without any condemnation, without any fear of punishment. And he could explain to her why. When she knew why, she could understand what can be done to be of help and assistance. She knew the education system. You don't just become a principal, you go through the teaching ranks first of all. She was incredibly highly motivated. So highly motivated, she would sacrifice a safe career as a principal to do something which was always in the back of her mind, wanting to do, but never had the confidence or the inspiration to do it. And I gave her that confidence and inspiration, just a little talk, one afternoon. And anyway, when this boy gave a talk, well, even I was just cheering him about how this lady had trusted him. And he had trust to her, and they arranged his education in order to suit him. And he said, I think he held up the piece of paper, he's got his entrance to UWA. And then when you heard his story, that was like a miracle. You can get into university, you know, which was then the top university in West Australia, you get your place in there. And he showed it. He had. And there was one kid. It was hundreds of those kids she helped. And you can see just how powerful some of these teachings are. And how sometimes learning how to listen to somebody else can solve so many problems. Learning to listen to yourself. What do you need to complete your education on planet Earth? What do you need to be a better human being? What do you require to be more at peace with yourself and the world and be more effective to help other people not harm this world so much? What do you need? You listen to yourself. You know what that's called? That's called mindfulness. Awareness, but deep mindfulness, looking in the right places. And what do the other people you live with need? So don't just assume. And sometimes all you need to do is ask a question, listen to the answer, even the answer in silence. I've said this so many times, like the last time I gave a talk here, I think, this was actually in a retreat I was teaching online last week. When people ask, you know, what do you do with animals, your pets who have cancer? You take them to the vet, and the vet said they need to be euthanized. That's an old question, but it's a very important question. For Buddhists, we're not supposed to kill any living beings. Does that include your cat who's got cancer and is really hurting? You can see it's hurting. What do you do? This anomaly, this conflict, should I let that vet euthanize the cat or should I just take it home? And of course, the answer is an easy answer, which we've practiced many times over in our monastery, but the person who gave the best story, fortunately she's passed away now, Judy. She was one of our committee members years ago. Her little dog, she took to the vet. And the dog had cancer for quite a long time. And the vet said, look, there's nothing more we can do. I have to put it out of its misery and give it the injection. So it's okay if I kill your dog. And that's where Judy said, no. My teacher, me, told me that when this happens, just take the dog aside to a nice corner of the veterinary surgery, take it aside and just look in its eyes and just ask it, do you want to die? Are you ready to die? And if that's your dog, your cat, your pet, you ask it, you'll get an answer. In the same way in that meditation I taught, you ask your legs, are you okay? You get an answer. Your legs, after a while, you really feel those legs. No, I'm not okay, please move me. Or, yeah, I'm fine, leave me alone. That's the answers I get. And that's the answers you get from your pets. And that's the answer which she got from her little dog. The dog said, no, I don't want to die. I want to carry on for a while. And she heard that from her, not words, but her the feelings, so sensitive enough to know what that person wants to do, or in this case, what a dog wants to do. So, fine. She took that dog to the vet in the next room and said, no, I'm taking it home. I remember her telling me, I don't know how she exaggerated or whether it was accurate what she said, but she said that doctor really scolded her. You call yourself a Buddhist and compassionate and kind? That dog needs to die. It's suffering. You can't take it home like this, you cruel Buddhist. I'm never a Buddhist or something like that. He was really criticizing her and Buddhist religion or Buddhist path. But you know, she took the dog home. And she said, with so much joy on her face, she was a cheeky lady, good old Judy. She said, with a cheeky smile on her face, I took the dog back 6 months later. It made its own perfect recovery by itself. And I took it into the vet surgery and said, Judy, you Buddhists are very wise. I hope I become a Buddhist one day. Because it worked. The dog knew. This is actually where we learn how to listen. Don't just assume. Now listen to yourself. Listen to others. And sometimes you get answers you never ever expected. And sometimes, you know what it's like? Sometimes we want to talk to others and tell the truth, but people aren't listening. And of course, you know how you develop what I some time ago, I called it total listening. Many years ago, I think other people may have used that word for other things, but total listening for me is when you look at somebody, they're talking, and you don't think one thought in your head. You look, you feel, you don't just listen to the words and the meaning of the words you might find in a dictionary. You listen to how they're spoken. The body language, the tone of the voice, or the intensity of the voice. Because all these gives you many more clues which go way beyond what the actual word says. It's how it's said. And also sometimes you can actually feel. It's not a psychic power reading somebody's mind like this. Sometimes you can feel what they really mean. Beyond the words. You're total listening to someone in that silence. You're not assuming anything. Here he goes again. How many times do I have to listen to this? Blah, 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 blah. Keep your mind quiet and listen. When you total listen, it's amazing what information you can gather, not just from a dog, but from your partner, from yourself, from your boss. You get so much more information there. You get a huge amount of answers to these questions, why? And when you get those answers to the questions, why, that gives you so much more understanding of life and so much more ways to become peaceful and successful, non-judgmental, wise. Sometimes I ask myself, you know, why do people keep listening to me? Especially on things like marriage counseling when I've never been married, on drug counseling when I've never taken drugs, on finance matters when I've got no money at all. Come back. On computing when I'm hopeless at computing. What? On psychology? I've never had a psychology degree. I've never gone to a psychology lecture, I don't think ever. Why? And it was answered even a deeper level by my own teacher, Ajahn Chah. You know Ajahn Chah, he only went to 4 years of primary school. Grade 4, that was it, and he was out. That's all they had, 4 years. When I heard that, I thought, what am I studying with a fool like this for? He's totally uneducated. That's what you thought, first of all, but experience showed that this man was just so much wiser than I was, knew so much more about life. And I went to Cambridge, for goodness sake. It's supposed to be a good university. I don't know what university Ajahn Chah went to, but these days I prefer to go to his university than Cambridge. He learned so much more. It's only 4 years, just at primary school. Because, you know, he learned, you know, from other monks how to truly listen. And he said he learned so much from listening to nature in the forests, learning just why animals aren't afraid of you. Why you can see a snake and not be afraid at all. And the snake is not afraid of you at all, even though it's just a deadly snake. Why they can crawl on you. Many snakes crawled on me when I was, not the same time, thank goodness, but when you were a monk in Thailand, they never harmed you. We can have, or what I love saying as well, seeing a snake was far more dangerous, but I was at peace with that. But we had like tarantulas, you know tarantula spiders? People get very afraid of tarantulas. They're really cute little things. Actually big things, about the size of your hand. Because over in the northeast Thailand when I was in the hot season, sometimes, you know, after lunch, you know, you lay down, take a bit of a break, or just to stretch your body after all that meditation. And the tarantulas were in the ceiling, and sometimes they would fall on you. You had a bare chest, because it was really hot. And at least that's something you can do. No air conditioning or fans, no electricity. So I remember many, many times, and monks know this story, I told them many times, you were laying down there and a tarantula would fall from the roof onto your chest. Blah, 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 blah. And it'd run over your chest. And they'd never ever bite me. They really tickled. It was actually quite pleasant. So I was actually looking forward to the next tarantula to fall. Blah, 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 blah. You're welcome. Those are actually sensuous. I don't know what they had on their toes or feet or whatever, but I didn't mind that at all. And the big spiders. But anyway, they were nice. Maybe they were Buddhist spiders, I don't know. Or they were trained to be kind to you, but we were kind to them. So that way that we learned so much from nature. Why be afraid? And of course, you read all these stories about snake time in these forests. No one's ever been bitten by a snake in Bodhinyana Monastery, have they? No, never. Many dangerous snakes around, but they're really kind, they're really cute. Have you ever actually looked at a snake, you know, in the wild? They're beautiful beings. We got the beautiful Dugite, isn't it, over in Jhana Grove? Yeah, so any of you going to Jhana Grove for a retreat, hopefully, if you're lucky, you meet our Dugite. Big snake, how long is it? It's maybe 2 meters? A couple of meters, yeah, big one. I haven't found out yet whether it's a boy or a girl. I haven't sort of looked to have a look. I don't know. I'm sure they're different. They're both all welcome. But anyway, it sort of hangs out sometimes when it's really hot. And it's not afraid of anybody. It just stays there. And sometimes you get some visitors from overseas. We don't have those visitors from overseas anymore because of COVID. But then they come up and take their photograph of the of the Dugite. We tell them, don't, you might scare the Dugite. But the Dugite just sits there. Well, doesn't sit there, just lays there, just enjoying itself. Never does any harm. So anyway, you learn so much from nature. Any people over in this world hurt you or harm you? Why? If snakes don't harm you, why should people harm you? A lot of the times it is our nature. If we're not really listening and don't know why, sometimes we get harmed again and again and again. One of my best friends, we used to go to the same places, he always was getting beaten up. I never got beaten up. I never understood why that was the case. You know, the same places, the same routes and same... He was always getting hit and beaten up. Me, I never did. And actually, that's something he said about me when he came to visit many years ago. And he said that's one thing he noticed, even at school, in high school. All boys' school. And he said the one thing he noticed with me that I never got into any arguments or got beaten up. Every other kid did. And I never noticed that, of course, because you learn how to be non-threatening, to be kind, to be peaceful. And that's helped me so many times. Okay, I can't resist these stories. I must know these stories so many times. But yeah, oh, they're great stories. When I said this first story, when I was visiting my mother in London, and I was going for give a talk at the Sri Lankan temple in London. And this is where I grew up. I knew the place. It's where I grew up. It's about an hour's walk, a nice little walk, you know, from my mother's apartment to the Sri Lankan temple and give a talk there. But this time I went past one of the really rough areas of Acton, South Acton, where there was this criminal estate where the police said a hotbed of crime. It's like low socio-economic area. And so when I was walking down the road and I saw all these youths, they were beginning to congregate for the evenings, whatever they were going to get up to. And I was going to walk right towards them. And of course they saw me walking towards them in my monk's robe. And then when they saw me, they all turned to look at me. It must have been about 13 or 14 of them, young men, up to no good. And then they started chanting, Buddha, 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 Buddha. As I got closer, louder, they were trying to intimidate me, make me scared. Buddha, 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 Buddha. Now a sensible monk would have turned around and run away or gone to the other side of the road. But I'm not going to do that. I am not going to be stopped in my path. So very calmly I just walked right towards them. And when I was maybe about 2 meters away from them, and there were lots of them, I'm really outnumbered, big guys. When I got to about 2 meters in front of them, still looking without any fear on my face, that's when I lifted up my hands into what I thought was a kung fu pose. I've never done kung fu before. I've only seen it on the TV before as a monk. in my kung fu pose. And this is no exaggeration, no joke. I don't know why I did that. It was a stupid thing to do, I must admit. But nevertheless, it worked. So the kids, they just moved away and let me walk right through them. They never touched me. Because they didn't know if it was true or not, I could do kung fu. But it looked like it, bald head, brown robes, walking without any fear towards them. That's what I learned from the snakes. If you have no fear, they won't harm you. But the other time, again, it was also just a beautiful story, which I rarely told here. That was a time when, over in Bunbury, I used to go down to Bunbury to teach in the prison. But it was only in the evening time, so in the afternoon I had free time. I went to Bunbury Beach to meditate. And there's lots of stories about my Bunbury Beach meditations, but this was... you know that one. Oh, okay, I have to tell this now because I just mentioned it in passing. That it's a quiet place, Bunbury Beach, out of town a little bit. And I was just sat there meditating, and just really nice time to meditate. And I was just very peaceful, about 2 hour meditation, just really getting inside, not worrying about the world at all. So I couldn't even hear the world outside. But you know what happened when I came out of meditation? There was someone sitting next to me, my left hand side, and another person sitting on my right hand side. And you can feel that someone's sitting as you come out of meditation. They weren't sitting there when I started. And I looked at the girl, it was a girl, on my left hand side, in a bikini, 17 years old. I'll say why I know it was 17 years old in a moment. This beautiful girl in a bikini, sitting next to a monk. And on the other side, there was another girl in a bikini sitting next to me. There's two, well, anyone, if they'd taken my photographs, I'd be dead. Like Ajahn Brahm with his two girlfriends on Bunbury Beach in the afternoon. That's what it looked like. But actually, what it really was, the truth of that story was, I didn't know this, but it was the last day of the end of year 12 exams. University entry, I forgot what they called it those days, but anyway, you know what I'm talking about. And there's a school the opposite side of the road. It was quiet when I went to sit there because it was early afternoon and they were just still finishing their last exam. And then I'd meditated there and of course they finished. And what do people do if you've got the school right next to the beach? Change into your bathers and go and enjoy yourself. Yay, end of school. All the exams done, yay. And I didn't know that. I was just meditating and just like, and they sat there, they're really nice girls. They were just saying, well, we saw you meditating here. We didn't know who you were, what you were doing. We were really interested. We were waiting about half an hour for you to come out of meditation so we can talk to you. So they asked some really nice questions, but I must admit, I answered those questions very quickly and escaped as soon as I could. Because I didn't know what people would say if they saw me. Fortunately, they didn't have these smartphones in those days. For smartphones, you can take a few shots and then I'm done for. Even though I was totally, totally innocent. And I knew there were 17-year-olds because that's what the age when you do your final exams. But anyway, on another occasion, a bit earlier, that was when I was meditating there. And I hadn't got into deep meditation yet, so I could hear it when it happened. This went past my head. And then another stone whistled past my head. And then another. And then I could hear somebody shout, "Get off our beach, you stupid Rajneeshi." That was a time, you remember when Sri Bhagwan Rajneesh was threatening to come to Western Australia? And they didn't know, they were kids, and they thought, brown robes, bald head, it's a Rajneeshi. And then another stone came past, and then another stone came past. I realized, you know, they weren't very good shots, but just by the law of probability, because I was a mathematician before, I knew the law of probability, I assumed one would hit. So I couldn't carry on sitting there. So I got up. But there's no way I'm going to run away. I stood up, turned, and started walking towards them. There's about 6 or 7 young guys, 13 or 14. I know what happened. It was amazing. We don't show fear. Those guys started running away. You know, from a little monk. They had all the stones. I had nothing, just my ropes. But anyway, the one of them stayed, which was good. All the others, they scarpered. And I went up to the guy who was left and said, look, I'm not a Rajneeshi, I'm a Buddhist monk. What's the difference? And I explained the difference to them. And they said, look, you know, even if I was a Rajneeshi, it's not a really good idea to throw stones at people. That makes you worse than the people you don't like. And then all the others came back when they saw me talking to this guy. We had a really nice conversation about non-violence, about acceptance, and about sort of not being afraid. It was a wonderful time. I always remember that story of talking to these kids about Buddhism and kindness. So instead of running away through fear, I'd have been the big loser there. I went towards them, could teach them a nice little lesson on Buddhism. I always felt very happy about that one. So anyway, that's what you learn when you have total listening. You're not afraid. And in fact, it gives you much more power. You can understand how people, how animals, how life works to create a much more beautiful, peaceful world. Okay, and now it's getting close to 8:50. Well, it's a bit longer than that. But anyway, so now we'll finish off the formal part of the talk. And I hope it made sense to you. I thought I was going to fall asleep tonight in my own talk, because I didn't get much sleep last night, I had a really busy day. But nevertheless, one thing I have learned is you have confidence and trust, and just let these things happen, see what happens. So I hope you enjoyed it today. A few little stories, some I hope you haven't heard of for a long time. So now we have some questions. First of all, we have the questions from overseas, if you don't mind. And that gives you a chance to start thinking if you need to. And we have the microphones over there, if you wish to go to the microphones to ask a question. Okay, we have, oh my goodness me. They say over here, Friday night with Ajahn Brahm, questions selected from over 675 viewers worldwide. 675 people tuned in tonight. Stephen Doyle, Ajahn Brahm, how do I deal with procrastination? Since the lockdown, I find it difficult to complete tasks. It's not procrastination, it's like perfectionism. Because sometimes we don't want to complete tasks, we don't think they're good enough to be completed. I need to do a bit more. It needs to be polished up. That's again one thing you learn in life. It doesn't have to be perfect to be finished. It's good enough. So sometimes, you know what it's like? The good example is writing a book. You write a book and you look at it, oh, it needs, you know, I can do better than this. And so you do a second draft and then a third draft and a fourth draft and a fifth draft and it never gets published. Because it's not perfect enough. Usually the best thing to do is just to do it. Maybe once, just give it a proofread, and then publish it. It doesn't have to be perfect to be finished and successful. That's the same way. Any guys here would understand this. In the morning time when I get up, you have to shave. Oh, that's just so difficult. Because a monk, we can't grow a beard. Give me a chance, I'd grow a beard. I used to have a nice beard. I used to have a beard and bushy hair, curly hair, and it was like called the donut look. Because the hair went all the way down here. Where the hair stopped, the beard started. And it caused a nice little circle all the way around. And in between were my eyes, mouth and nose. And it's really practical. If ever you've lived in London during the winter time, you don't need a hat if you've got the donut look. You've got your own insulation there. So that was really nice. I really enjoyed that. But anyway, when you are shaving, I've got to shave now because I'm a monk and you can't grow beards. And I sometimes look in the mirror and it keeps scratching and scratching. It's still not clean yet. You know, and oh my goodness, how often do I need to shave to be perfect? And after a while I say, this is good enough. Because you're not a perfectionist. I've learned that also from nature. You never see anything perfect in nature. In other words, it's beautiful, but not totally straight. So, difficult to complete task. Yeah, it's like washing the dishes. This is my way of washing the dishes. Before, if you go home this evening, before you go to wash the dishes, have a look at how many clean plates and saucers you have. You know, in the drawers or in the shelves. Have a look at how many dirty dishes you have. Count them, compare them. And if the number of clean dishes outnumber the dirty dishes, then quit while you're ahead. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. That's the truth. So that's true. Actually, these days I can practice that because other people clean my dishes for me. The monks. Okay, anyway. So a lot of time it's not procrastination, it's trying to be perfectionist. You can't let the task be completed because you think you can make them better. From USA, can you please explain it if it is like a recycle for the worldly things with no beginning and no end, similar to the rebirth for all being zero for things too? I'm not quite sure what you mean there, but nevertheless, I will make it up as I go along. Recycling for worldly things with no beginning and end. There is a beginning and an end, but the end is a start of a new beginning. Just like there was an end to 2020, and has been recycled into 2021. Does it feel different? Does it feel different? So actually there is no new year. It's all a big con. So why did you have a party last night? Be true. We just make use of these things because they're helpful to have a day off work. No beginning, no end. There's no even when it does get recycled, it always gets recycled differently. There's a change, even one life to another life. It's always a tiny bit different. Because it's a tiny bit different, there's a time of growth and change and making things better or making things wiser. So, even worldly things, they get recycled, but recycled better or worse, and that's what we can do something good for. From Mumbai, always feel anxiety and worry about work and before starting work and sometimes no reason, but I start to feel anxious. I don't know how to deal with these feelings. Maybe I don't know what your work is. If it's like a firefighter, then maybe it's good to feel a bit anxious. But no, for most work, you don't need to feel anxious. Anxiety is looking into the future and seeing all the things which might go wrong. As for me, I look at the future and see all the things which might go right. With a positive mind, you look in the future and just see all the things which could be wonderful in this world. And even if there's something which goes wrong, if I give a really, really, really bad talk, yay! Now I don't need to give any talks anymore, I can retire, at last I can retire. So, can you please, if you give any comments, say this is the worst talk you've ever heard, you don't want to hear Ajahn Brahm again. You'll be your friend for life if you say something. So I can relax and rest. But no. You give, trying to help as many people as possible. Do I look like I'm worried? Have you seen me being anxious? Do I hide it well? Or is it just not there? Because a lot of times, if something does go wrong in my life, then I use it as the old story of fertilizer for the mango tree. Never be afraid. Here we go again. First time, this is only the first time I've told this anecdote this year. If you tread in the dog shit, take it home with you. Don't scrape it off before you get home. You know that story. Which means they only scrape it off under the mango tree in your garden. Because then next year your mangoes will be sweeter and juicier than ever before. That's how I look at negativity. If negativity happens, dig it in. It's great fertilizer for more wisdom and compassion. So that means nothing can go wrong. Just things go differently. And what once you thought was wrong is just more fertilizer for your understanding and wisdom. So therefore you don't have any anxiety. See what happens. Lastly, dear Ajahn Brahm, you exude confidence. Am I exuding today? honesty and kindness. Ah. We're blessed for your presence. Ah. Yet you're a scientist. Uh-oh. Trained to be logical. Question, how do we attain such a quality of self? I teach this every week. If I told you the answer, the total answer right now, then you wouldn't come back next week, would you? So I'm not going to tell you the answer, because otherwise I'd be out of a job. No, I think there's a lot of it. It's the meditation is really powerful. Gets you in this present moment, you develop lots of kindness right from the very beginning, caring for your body and being aware of it. The kindfulness to each one of you, positive attitude, whatever happens is, oh, it's something you can do. Total listening, being aware, and of course, whatever happens, you're not going to lose anything. I told a story to monks last week, and I told it even this afternoon to Ayachanda, who I had a talk with. The very first time I gave a big talk was in Singapore, in Suntec City Convention Center, and 5,000 people turned up to watch. I was the only speaker. And when I walked in there, I had time to think, uh-oh, this is really dangerous. Because you know what happens if there's too many people that get so egotistical and proud, and they think they're, you know, the guru of the modern age. And we get 5,000 people, that's a lot of people for a gig. And so when I walked in, I thought, this is difficult. Be careful, Ajahn Brahm. I've seen too many other people getting egotistical and proud. So I remembered the only reason why I'm giving this talk is because the training I've had from a great teacher like an Ajahn Chah and from the wonderful teachings of the Buddha and all these other people, even my parents, the people I've known in my life. And I realized in a very deep way, they were the people giving the talk, not me. All the people who influenced me, inspired me, I learned from, they're the ones who actually made this talk interesting for people. And it wasn't Ajahn Brahm's talk. Even right now, the talk which you're hearing today, it wasn't by Ajahn Brahm. It was by all the people I've learned from over these years. All the kind people I've talked with, all the questions you've asked online. You're the ones who gave this talk, not me. So when you depersonalize it, it's part of the anatta non-self doctrine. When you depersonalize it, you don't own it. Then of course you have no anxiety or fear. It's not mine. And that actually is one of the key ways of being able to give a talk without any fear at all. So, any questions from the audience here before we finish off? I'm really amazed you all stayed up so late again. Of course, Eddie, wouldn't be the New Year. I thought you made a New Year's resolution not to ask it. Come on, Eddie.
It's the question, you know, on the quality of self, you know. Woke me up, you know, I think, yeah. You know, the Buddha was asking us to look inside. Yeah. So the quality of self is not our outside look, you know, our beauty, you know, it's the inside of us, you know. Yeah. And also the other quality, don't you think, like, when we view the outside person, you know, okay, if the beauty of the person is not the looks, the face, body, the legs, anything, you know, it's the inside of the person, you know.
Yeah. That's very reassuring when you get old.
What do you think is the insight, isn't it?
But it's very true too. And that's why we have, like, you know, people who are so-called deformed. I just really don't like that word, deformed or disabled or something, because that's already a judgment. You see, people, they don't look, you know, like the average human being. But, you know, sometimes you get to hear them, talk to them. Some of my favorite people, because, you know, I volunteered and looked after some of these people for 2 years when I was at Cambridge University, just my little bit of social service, was people with Down syndrome. And, oh, I learned so much from what you say, looking inside. Mm-hmm. And see, there's all wonderful people, really wise. And I told you one of those stories, I think you've heard it before. I used to go to Forborn Hospital, I think on a Thursday afternoon or something, every day for, I think, for 2 years, my social service. It's supposed to be just being a goody-goody, but I enjoyed it so much. And I remember just one of these Down syndrome beings, they weren't kids, they were just 18, 19, 20 or something. And they were running up towards me one day when I was visiting. And they were not saying anything. They put their arms around me and gave me this huge hug. I said, what did you do that for? I said, what's wrong? Now, my lay name was Peter. What's wrong? I said, what do you mean, what's wrong? I said, you're suffering, aren't you? They saw it straight. I'd broken up with my girlfriend that night before. And these Down syndrome people, they saw it straight away. How the hell did you know that? I said, just by your look. So there's so many things, they surprise me. When you looked inside, there's incredible wisdom and kindness and goodness there. You look on the outside, and they look different. But for some of these people, they don't look the same as... Same as what, I don't know. But anyway, incredibly beautiful people inside. So you can never judge. So as you say, it's right. What's inside is most important.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Eddie. Okay, I had a late night this morning. I didn't have a night last night, I was up all night. So for the New Year's Eve. So now we can pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can have a nice, peaceful evening. And hopefully the monks who were up last night had some Venerable Mudito, and I can have a nice rest in our beds.
Do you reckon that's going to happen?
Arahaṃ sammasambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami.
Very good. Okay.
And from all of the monastic community, Happy New Year! Okay, thank you. Okay, just messing around.
I think this happened. I'm exhausted after that.
Executive committee meeting.
All right.